My name is Clancy Emmisland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I know that you had a good meeting last night. I heard about that, and I wanted to be here, but I had to be in Santa Monica. And this morning I got up, and I was really excited about coming here and felt good, but I'd made one error. I booked on TWA. I don't judge, but if I judged, I'd judge them. We sat, had to get up early, get out of the airport, and sit there for 3 hours while they tried to fix the rubber band on the plane. And then we finally took off. Terrible trip and bumped, and the guy went out of his way to find clouds and blah, blah, blah. And we got here, and everything was fine. I got off the plane a little tired, and I got one sense of reward when I got here. It really was, because for many, many years, I've sponsored people. That's always been the thing that I hold, that I believe to be a thing you should do and makes you feel good. There's nothing better than AA than sponsorship, I believe. And I've been privileged to sponsor a man here in St. Louis for a number of years. And sometimes when you sponsor people, especially when you're a strong sponsor, you have the tendency sometimes to make people dependent on you too much. And they don't have any self-will or freedom. And that's always a problem with strong sponsors, that they develop people who are not able to function for themselves. Well, I'm glad that I've been able to bring my man in St. Louis through that stage well, because he was supposed to pick me up at the airport today, and he had other plans. So I stood at the airport moodily holding my bag and looking off with a 10,000-mile stare and thinking about TWA and where the hell this conference is going to be. And suddenly I had a surge of warmth. I thought to myself, thank God Dave has broken free from the shackles that I've imposed on him. I think we ought to give him a hand. Stand up, Dave. Next time you have a depression, look in the mirror. But I'm glad. It really was no big deal. I just got over here very easily to get here, no problem at all. And there was a mix-up, and it wasn't really his fault. But why forgive him? Screw him. I've been in St. Louis several times over the years. At Stouffer's, they had an annual banquet there. God, must be almost 20 years ago. And I talked at Washington University at some kind of a state convention, which was one of the more hideous memories of my life. And then a year and a half or 2 years ago, I was here at the Fall Classic, where I'm afraid it didn't go over very well there. I talked about AA. And now I'm here. It's just one exciting time after another. And as I was looking around the room tonight, looking up, you know, they all say, you wonderful young people, you're the AA leaders of tomorrow. And my response to that is, I'm glad I won't be here to see it, although I am. But the people ahead of me thought the same thing, and so, you know, it's only fair. But I had an interesting call the other day, and it reminded me of being young a little bit. It's a long memory, but I got a call, and they said, would you come and talk at the anniversary of the alcoholic program at the U.S. Naval Hospital at Pearl Harbor on July 8th? I said, yes, I'll be glad to. And as I hung up the phone, I got thinking, isn't that what a strange thing? Because on or about July 8th, 1943, I was 15 years old, coming into Pearl Harbor on a ship, and I had my first drink that I held down, because the next day I was 16 and I had my first hangover. And now it's going to be 44 years later to the day that I'll be back in Pearl Harbor. And it doesn't go anywhere from there, but it's a nice thought for a moment. going to explain how being the adult child of a Norwegian Lutheran had hurt my life. I know that people, adult children of alcoholics, feel that's bad, but at least alcoholics pass out and they go to the bars, but Norwegian Lutherans just stay on you day and night. You've done it wrong again. But I had my first drink on that ship, and that I loved it. I had no idea that alcohol had an unusual effect on me. You know, it's a funny thing. It's this effect that makes people an alcoholic is a special effect. And it comes at different times in different lives. That's why there are some people who are bad drinkers in their teens, and there are some people who drink for 35 years before they cross an invisible line, as they say, and get this special effect, and anywhere in between. And that's why we have this paradox in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, like so often at a meeting, some old fool will get up and say, I drank for 38 years, and look accusingly at some little snippet in the front row, as if to say, how can you be an alcoholic, you little snot? I drank longer than you've been alive. You know? And what the old fool doesn't realize is the young snipper sitting there thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 38 years, you old son of a bitch. And it turns out it isn't how long you drank, but it's when it started to have a special effect to do something for you that it doesn't do for most people. I had no idea when I held that first drink down on that ship that it did something special for me. If I knew what I knew now, I would know it immediately. That special effect is what transforms drinkers into alcoholics. And everybody's got their own version of it. If you listen at meetings sometimes, or hear speakers, they describe something that they used alcohol for. Like a few weeks ago, again, I heard in one of my home groups, the very, very beautiful movie star, one of the most beautiful movie stars in the world, just most attractive, lovely woman, just wonderful. And she was explaining how when she was fighting drinking, the reason she had to drink is because when she stayed sober, she felt clumsy and unattractive. And she didn't feel like they wanted her to be on screen, so she always had to have a few drinks to get that feeling of being attractive so she could transmit it. I sponsor a guy who used to play center for the San Francisco 49ers. Big guy. I'll tell you, when he was new and crazy, I almost compromised with him a couple times. Boy, don't feel like going to meetings? Well, shit, you don't have to go to meetings. No, I didn't really, but I thought about it. But he talked about how he and one of the other linemen, interior linemen of the 49ers, and he couldn't understand it. Everybody else was eager to get out there, and he was always afraid before the game. He just felt inadequate. And they always, he and the other guy always came back before and had a couple hits before they went out there. Absolutely forbidden. But as soon as he had those hits, he knew he could take that linebacker and knock him on his can all the way across the field. And everybody's got their own thing that alcohol does for them. And what alcohol did for me, I suppose, is something I wouldn't have thought of at the time, but I think about it now. The reason I wanted to drink so badly is because they'd given me a drink on that ship leaving San Francisco, and I threw up, and they all laughed at me. And I tried to drink all the way across the Pacific Ocean, I didn't want to drink. I wanted to look like a man to those grown-ups, because I was small and skinny and pimply-faced and didn't know anything. Came from a little town up in Wisconsin. I'd hitchhiked out there and got seaman's papers, was at sea without a day's training. Didn't know anything. And I wanted so desperately to look like a man. And when I held that drink down, finally, the thing that it did for me was something considerably more than that, but I didn't even think about it except in retrospect, years later. I didn't care if I looked like a man or not. I felt the way men looked. It seems as though it just changed me. And I grew up and my pimples fell off, and if I'd have known a sea chanty, I'd have sung it. And then I threw up again and it all went away and the pimples jumped on my face and I shrunk again. But for a few moments, I had the feeling that I felt the way other people looked as though they felt. And many years later, after many circumstances, I took my last drink. By that time, I was considerably more slick and more blasé, and I'd been around, and I'd done a lot of things. I'd been every place and done everything, and I'd been successful in the world. I'd had a lot of therapies for my emotions. I've had a lot of things. If someone came up to me then and said, "Why do you drink?" it depended on how I felt. If I were in one of my moods emanating from psychoanalysis, I might explain that the reason I drank is because of the psychic scars caused by an unhappy childhood, a deprived childhood, growing up during the Depression, not getting enough love, having conflicts with the environment in which I lived because I was ill prepared to deal with them. That's why I drink. Or if I were in one of my metaphysical moods, I might describe what the reason I drink is because of the deep-seated irresolution between the external being and the inner spirit, which I must try to find a rapprochement. Or if I were in one of my ordinary moods, I'd say, "Why don't you go screw yourself?" Yeah. But the one thing I would never have answered, because I wouldn't have understood it, I never would have said, "I am drinking to feel the way men look." And that was as true then, I guess I see it now, but wouldn't have known it then, as it was when I started. Now, there's nothing wrong with drinking to feel the way men look when you're a 15-year-old pimply-faced little puke in the Pacific. But when you're getting old and wrinkled and bald and your kids are grown up, you should start feeling grown up pretty soon. Yeah. As the old saying goes about people like me, and I'm sure some of the others in this room, didn't have a happy childhood, but I had an endless one. It just went on and on. I was thinking about it. I'm going to have my 60th birthday in Pearl Harbor in July 8th when I go over there to address the dreadful sailors. And I hope by that time to be able to tell them what I want to do when I grow up. One of these days I got to make that decision. But drinking has always been a great friend to me. Drinking is the best thing I ever found in my life. It hurts me to this day to hear people get up and attack alcohol. "That alcohol, terrible, it was always terrible, dreadful, goddamn stuff." It's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend, you know. Well, she may be a beast now, but God, she used to be something. She wasn't always bad. Drinking was a great help to me because my problems emanated from things way beneath what seemed to be superficial reasons. Later in the war, I went in the Navy. And while I was in the Navy, I took some tests that enabled me to not have to go back to high school. I'm still a junior in high school up in Wisconsin, but I was able to go to the University of Wisconsin. And I got through college. I went out in the world. I became a sports writer. Then I'd married this charming girl in college. And she seemed exotic to me, because I was a Norwegian Lutheran and she was a Catholic. And I'd been kept away from Catholics most of my life because they wanted to put the Pope in the White House. And my grandmother was telling me, she said, "Oh, sonny," she said, "don't marry her. Charlotte's a nice girl, but don't marry her. She's a Catholic." I said, "Grandma, that's ridiculous. This is the brave new post-war world. We just went over there fighting the Japanese to keep bigotry off America. I'm going to marry this girl. We're going to live in happiness." And I married her, and my grandmother was right. It isn't that she was a bad girl, just the opposite. She was a good girl. We were talking about that at the table before the meeting tonight. And there's something they never tell Lutheran boys about good Catholic girls. That if you're a Lutheran boy and you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family. Ready or not. And I used to plead to her, I'd say, "Charlotte, this is the brave new post-war world. This is ridiculous. Can't we use birth control?"
"No."
I said, did we get something just for the prevention of disease? They sell them in a vending machine over here at Rocky's Rockaway. I never thought I'd live to see them advertised on television, I'll tell you. She said, no. And then a priest came by and he gave me a lecture on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic version of birth control. And I listened intently and I just couldn't pick up that beat. I just... I became a distributor of small Catholics nationwide. In fact, it's still going on. Last Sunday, one of my daughters gave birth to her third child. Another generation of Catholics just flooding the area. And that daughter is really a touching thought to me because she married a guy I sponsored. I sponsored him for 5 years, and then he and my daughter fell in love and got married, and he's been sober a long time now. They got 3 kids. But if you ever want mixed feelings, if you ever want to be glad you're a schizophrenic so you can have 2 sets of feelings, watch your daughter walk down the aisle with someone whose 5th step you've heard. You can't say anything, but you can hint. Don't ever let them bring a sheep home, honey. Little things like that. But all of these years I drank, and I drank heavily sometimes. By 1949, I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous. About the same age many of you are tonight, I suppose, younger than some of you. I was 22, and I was the youngest person in Alcoholics Anonymous by over 10 years in the whole state. There weren't any young people in AA at that time. And I hung around AA a while, but it never attracted me. It looked to me like I was right in the middle of God's waiting room, just a bunch of old pukes waiting to die. Just sit there waiting for a voice to say, next. One of them get up and walk off to heaven, I guess. But the big thing that they always talked about that made me feel different was, they said, if you stop drinking, if you're an alcoholic, things will be okay. And I stopped drinking, and things didn't get okay because I had a different set of problems, apparently, than alcoholics have. And for the next few years, I worked very hard to overcome, to find a solution to those problems. I at one time spent several $1,000s in psychoanalysis. Now there are people in AA who say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I don't know if you should or not. There are some people today who say you should go to psychoanalysis. I would question that too. I see a psychiatrist once a week myself now, and people say to me, if AA works so well, why do you see a psychiatrist once a week? And the answer is very simple. Because I told him if he doesn't come to Wednesday night meeting, I won't be his sponsor. That's why I see him. He goddamn well better be there. What? Sometimes like St. Louis, it's just like a bad dream. I thought you had the biggest McDonald's in the world, and I discovered that arch is something else down there. Well, I'm a World War II veteran, you people. Anyway, I haven't said anything yet, so I haven't missed anything. I'll get it. But I went into psychoanalysis, and I went to spend $1,000 in psychoanalysis. And as I said, I found a lot of reasons why I drank. And a lot of reasons why I have these feelings. And they all seem valid to me. For example, my sensitivity to rejection, I came to believe, was because when I was little and my parents were both teachers, in the Depression, they had to go to other cities to teach. and they left me with my grandparents, and that left me with a deep sense of depression and rejection. And later I thought about that, you know, I don't remember it that way at all. My grandparents were from Norway, and I was their only grandson they had for hundreds of miles, and they treated me like a little prince. Just anything I wanted I could have, don't you say? My grandmother would make homemade root beer, and she'd have these bottles of ice-cold homemade root beer. I'd say, "Grandma, I want some root beer." My grandma would say, "Look at here, he wants some root beer. Here you are, sonny." And my grandpa would say, "And here's some cookies, too." When my parents came home, it all went to hell. "I want some root beer." "Not before dinner." "What do you mean, not before dinner?" "I want some root beer." "No." "Yeah." "Well, why don't you go back to where you were?" And when they left, I felt rejected, the doctor said. Huh. I didn't know I'd had a deprived childhood. I remember one day the doctor saying to me, "You mean to say, Mr. Emerson, at this time in 1935, in this little town, you didn't even have a bicycle?" I said, "No." But I got thinking about it on the way home. I just went into a terrible depression for about 2 months. Every time I wanted to feel bad, all I had to do was visualize a little tousled-haired, apple-cheeked, blue-eyed little tyke standing alone on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles to and fro. "Don't worry about me. I'll go into analysis later." God, it just brought tears to my eyes. It took me almost 2 months to remember nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle in 1935. One kid did. We thought he was a freak. We beat him up and broke his bicycle. No. I had all sorts of things. I shoved ahead in school when I was little, and that left me at different peer pressures, and on and on. And I'll tell you, I found a whole set of reasons why it seemed to me I felt strange and different. Why I had anxiety. Why I had loneliness sometimes. Why I felt insecure. Why I felt different. Why I felt easily rejected. And I wanted to do something about those feelings for one great reason, among other reasons. There are many reasons I want to do something about them. But the number one reason, as I went along in the world, those are wimp emotions. At least if I'm going to have emotions, let me have macho emotions. Masculine emotions. "Yeah, I'm all right, except my foot just fell off, but I'm all right." Yeah. "No, I'm afraid." You can't talk to people about it. "How are you doing today?" "Oh, I'm insecure." "How do you like the job?" "Oh, I'm afraid." "What are you afraid of?" "Take the shit out of me." You intuitively know that's the wrong posture. And so people devise defenses against it. "How you doing?" "Fine." "I'm doing fine." "Are you sure?" "Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure." Or sometimes if you're not in mood, you can take refuge behind an intellectual defense. I've done a lot of reading. I'm an excellent intellectual. Say things like, "Is that the way it seems to you?" Perhaps if you do a little more reading and a little less thinking, you might be better adjusted. Or you could be cool. "Hey, baby. What's coming on down, baby?" "I don't care about nothing."
"I'm going to get me a Harley and run over a truck." "Oh, ho, ho, ho."
Any kind of defense So you won't see that a lot of the times I'm just a wimp. I feel different in issues. Hard to be a sports writer. Hard to be a good writer. Hard to work in big, slick operations and be a wimp. So you're not a wimp. Slick, one-liners, cute, clever, dress differently, look differently, pretend to be different by choice. Something to remember sometime. It takes a little security to be able to look and act like other people. And I, all these years, I did a lot of things. I got into metaphysics one time, and I don't like to brag because I'm not tough enough to live in St. Louis without having people come in here and brag. But at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And that's a heavy load to carry in Texas. They got jealous and put me away. I read books. If any of you are imitation intellectuals, you might like Friedrich Nietzsche. He's wonderful. Especially if you are having trouble with God, because one of his characters, one of his treatises says, "Why are you concerned about God? God is dead. He may have created the universe, but look at the anarchy around you. There's no divine force here. People live in terror of something that's no longer existent. Don't worry about God. God is dead." And that gets to be quite a big thing. He wrote that in 1884. There's a theological seminary in Chicago where they have it forever etched on the wall. It says, "God is dead." Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. And beneath it, it says, "Nietzsche is dead." Signed God, 1906. You know. You never want to read the second lines of those things. They always got a moral to them. But I read Nietzsche. I did a lot of things. But the best thing I ever found in my life, I didn't even realize it, a few drinks makes me feel wholer than all the philosophies and therapies that I ever had. I think it's safe to say that if you're an alcoholic, two martinis will do more for you than 2 years of psychoanalysis. If you're an alcoholic, a bottle of wine will bring more comfort than 1,000 hours of philosophical reading. It just makes things all right. It fills my holes. And I never thought, you know, I thought about that a lot of times. Over the years, I've often thought, it always seemed to me, other people didn't have holes. I was the only one who had holes. And that's one of the reasons I had to conceal them so much. Because other people were what they seemed to be. That's why I would say, I wanted to drink to feel the way they looked. Later I discovered they didn't feel the way they looked either. But I didn't know that. And if people didn't drink, that indicated to me they didn't have any holes to feel. I didn't have any idea that alcohol did something different for me than it did for them. But over the years, I drank and I tried to control things. I went to AA from time to time and did a lot of things. And the only problem I really had was that I have a tendency, unfortunately, to overfill my holes from time to time. And when that happens, a new personality comes in, and I have a tendency sometimes to become what judges and policemen have described as bizarre. Now, there's nothing wrong with being bizarre when you're a kid, I guess. Here, I say, "Oh." No, we don't want your name yet. We'll have a countdown later. I look back to when I was a teenager and say, "Boy, I really had fun after the prom last night. Peed in the hotel lobby." But as you get older and become self-supporting, it gets tougher and tougher. And being bizarre is no longer cute anymore for after a while. And it starts to be a lot of problems. And especially if you're cursed with heterosexuality and have a bunch of kids growing up around you, because they want women bored on a continuing basis. They don't want to hear why they're not getting it. and a wife who's grinding you, and jobs trying to hold it together. And I did a lot of things, a lot of therapies, a lot of actions, and I had some successes followed by failures, by successes, by failures. One spring I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in the suburb of Chicago. 10 months later I was playing piano in a whorehouse in San Francisco. Now, I'm not putting that down. It's kind of fun to go in there and see what those Catholics are doing, I'll tell you. Never see any blondes in those places, I'll tell you that. All dark-haired people. But I always felt bad, and I got in that situation. I ran to a guy I'd been in the Navy with, and he was going to Texas. We went to Texas, hitchhiked to Texas. I got a job in the newspaper there, and a year and a half later, I'd really made a move, and I was working days at an advertising agency. At night, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas, directing a grand opera in the original Italian, writing a weekly sports column for the paper. That's kind of a wide variety of interest. 7 months later, I was in Texas Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. Committed there for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life. Now, I'll tell you something. When you're struggling to hold it together, and you find yourself committed for possibly the rest of your life to a state insane asylum, you have an intuitive feeling this is not going to look good on your resume. They're going to ask questions about that hole in there. And the only thing that saved me is that the next spring, well, one thing saved me from a lot of worry there. I was so despondent and so depressed that I almost never got out, because I wasn't in there for drinking. Nothing on my commitment papers ever said drinking. I was in there as a psychiatric case. So the reason I thought it was a psychiatric case is because at the university they told me I had to stop drinking. And my wife was pregnant again. And I needed that insurance to get that baby born, and I couldn't lose the job, and I couldn't drink, and I couldn't do anything, and it got worse and worse. What it does when I get sober, those holes form, and I tense and desperate. And one day my wife took the kids to church, and I just parked the car in the garage. I'd been sober too long. And I parked the car in the garage, ran a hose from the exhaust inside, turned on the motor, and went to sleep and died. I couldn't be just crazy. And a neighbor heard the motor running and came over and kicked open the door and pulled me out dead out of the garage and beat on my chest and breathed my mouth, and they rushed me to the psych ward and examined me intensely for 2 weeks, determined I was a badly split personality, a schizophrenic, and put me in the Texas State Insane Asylum. And I hadn't had a drink for some time. So it wasn't really anything to do with drinking, apparently. I've often thought about that. I'd like to go back. I've been in that city a couple times since, but I'd like to go back and find that psychiatrist. He must be old and feeble now. I should be able to move him around pretty good. And say, "You quack! You ought to lose your license. You examined me and gave me tests and studied me for 2 weeks and determined I was a dual personality. You idiot! If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it, for Christ's sake." My problem has always been, when the pressure comes on, a committee forms in my head, and they all get going at once. I think, well, let's get out of here. I don't know, let's just... I hear people in AA say, maybe I should get some group therapy. I never need group therapy. Just go for a ride alone in my car.
That's true.
Man. That's one of the reasons I drink. It cuts it down to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one, you know. But I sat there terribly depressed. And I might have been there yet, except one guy said, this hospital is escape-proof. I said, it is. And that got my heart started again. I could just feel the blood starting in again. It took me about 2 weeks. I found a way to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard and over the fence. And the fox was loose in West Texas. There's only one thing wrong, of course. That isn't escape-proof hospital, which you don't until you get out, which sounds strange. But you're over that fence, you suddenly realize, I don't know if you've ever been to West Texas, they can see you running for 3 days in any direction. And you feel like such a boob in your white bathrobe out there just... And it's just a matter of time when the field glasses pick you up. Well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they snatched me back and gave me a couple months of electric shock treatment. And when you have a couple months of electric shock treatment, you never worry again for a long time.
Do you remember my name? I don't.
But the next spring, they put in an alcoholic ward in that hospital in Texas. My memory had come back by that time, and I'd been in and out of AA for 7 years by now. I knew how to act like an alcoholic. So I pretended to be an alcoholic, got in their alcoholic program. Tell us about the fourth step, Mr. Ross. How can we get this garbage out and find a new life? And he'd tell me. And all the rest of the people in this ward were there who'd been committed by their families for 30 days. And they just hated it. And they were going to get out in 30 days no matter what. But I had to suck around because I was going to be there forever if I didn't get. And he, oh, Mr. Ross, say, are there any questions, boys, to this? I have several questions, Mr. Ross. And he'd say, fine. Everybody else would say, oh, shit. But I wasn't trying to impress them. I had to get him. You know, they weren't very sincere. He said, next to a meeting, with the guy said, what are you going to do to get out of here, Fred?
I'm going to kill that bitch.
You know. But I finally convinced him I was sincere. They used to take me out to little towns around there, and I'd give little talks showing the wonderful work they're doing at the hospital. To this day, when I hear people from out of institutions give talks, my eyes have a tendency to film over. Just, I'm sure they're more sincere than I was, but they'll never know. I'll give a little talk. Friends, I'm just proud to be here tonight in Odessa on behalf of my fellow patients at Big Spring State Hospital to thank you and many others who brought a program of faith and hope to us who are trapped in the vast desert of alcoholism. And we went across these burning sands and there was no respite. In the distance, we saw the tall green hills of sobriety, and we came upon them. They were too steep for our weary legs, but loving folks such as you pointed out 12 golden stairs that we could climb one at a time. And now we stand high atop the hill of sobriety, looking forward to returning to our homes through West Texas to find other lost wayfarers of this vast desert and saying, over here, there are some stairs you may follow. May God bless you forever in your wonderful work. You can laugh if you want to, but that got me out of the Texas nut house. And the funny thing is, I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. When you run out of Thorazine, you have a tendency to become edgy. And a year later, I was working in Dallas at the largest advertising agency in the South. Everybody knew that my act had been cleaned up. Now my potential would come to use. Five guys and I sat in a little cubicle, we called it the Borden Bullpen, and sat there day after day and tried to think of things for Elsie to say to Elmer and Elmer to reply to Elsie. And if you're old, you remember Elsie and Elmer the cause. If you're young, you may never heard of them, but there was this cow named Elsie, and she always wore yellow flowers in her horns, and she always wore an apron because didn't want anyone to see her boobs, even as a cow. And she was married to this bull named Elmer, and they had some twin calves, and then there was another calf named Beauregard. And they used to sit around a lot and talk about Borden milk products. And well, I guess you'd really have to be there to lose a little something. But I worked there and trying to hold it together, trying to keep those holes still so I wouldn't go crazy and try not to do too much. And one day it exploded again, and I was often a terrible drunk, and I came back, and my wife had taken the children and left. She finally left. She ignored advice for years from priests and all sorts of people, my intermittent sponsors in AA and my psychiatrist. They all said, get away from that drunken son of a bitch. And she finally did, and a couple weeks later, I woke up one morning. I was on the floor of the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank, and a guy had just got done kicking all my front teeth out. You think that's funny, sir? What kind of animal are you, for God's sake? One of the saddest stories I've ever heard. That was one of the few mornings I was really glad that I'd been in psychoanalysis, because once you've been in psychoanalysis, at least you have insights and understandings that most people don't have. And that morning, I was so sick I couldn't even move my head out of the way of this guy's shoe while he kicked my teeth out. But I thank God I was able to look up at him and almost instantly identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. And that gives you a feeling of superiority. And a short time after that, I was in California, and a couple of months after that, I was being 86th out of a Skid Row mission. And he said, get out of here and don't come back. And I tried to explain to him, hey, I'm not a bum. I'm not a bum. I'm a very talented guy. I've got awards for things I've written. I've directed a grand opera in Italia. I've done so many things. But it's hard to explain these things in midair. I'll come back and get you someday, you son of a bitch. I have a whole list of people I still got to get. And one morning it was cold and raining and I was dying on that sidewalk, and I walked 71 blocks out to that stinking AA club, and I'd been there 2 weeks before and been 86th because I thought I'd stolen the coffee money at the meeting, and I had to hassle those fools to let me in. And that's a terrible degradation. And I thought what I better do here with these boobs, you do the same thing I did in that Texas nut house. It's that bad now. I'm dying on the streets. I don't know what's wrong with me. I know I'm not an alcoholic. I know that based on 9 years of AA meetings. But there's something dreadfully wrong, but I'm going to die before I find out. What I better do is pretend to be an alcoholic for a while and play their sick little game till I can get a score and get out of this two-bit town. And I did that. And they always say, hey, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. Seemed to be a fairly decent type. I was wrong again. He was an intimidating person, and he made me take actions that insulted my intelligence. I hate almost more than anything to have people treat me like a wimp. I always have that secret feeling I'm a wimp, and I'm never going to let them think they are, that I am, by acting like one. But I was so desperate, I let that guy treat me like a wimp, and I played along with his goofiness. And I'd been to AA off and on for years. You know, AA is supposed to help you. I remember telling someone, I don't have any place to stay. I said, you don't? No. It says, out at the end of the AA parking lot, there's an old 1949 Mercury. Somebody left there a whole bunch of years ago. Sleeping there. Sleeping there? Yeah. So I said, I'll sleep in there a couple nights until somebody takes pity on me. And I slept in there for a couple nights, and a couple more nights, and a couple months, and just went on and on. And I was in the AA club parking lot, so I had a chance to get to a lot of meetings. My sponsor was just hideous. I tried to stay out of his way because he'd help me get jobs. I got a job as a janitor, my first job as a janitor. The guy in AA gave me a job as a janitor at a jewelry store, and he fired me on Christmas Eve because he said I was dusting too long amongst the watches. And he was right, boy. I'll tell you, I saw myself starting a new year in San Francisco saying, see anything you like? I'd have paid him back. I got a job as a furniture mover, last till noon. I was one of my sensitive moves. I think to myself, I'm a creative, sensitive person, and I'm being pushed around by a guy I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn. Hey, you! Without the teeth! You bumped my lamp! I said, no, you're mistaken, sir. I broke your goddamn lamp. You just can't push creative, sensitive people. I got a job as a dishwasher. I got fired. I was in one of my paranoid moods. It seemed to me that busboys were bringing in more dishes than the restaurant was using, which led me to deduce that they were getting them from other restaurants to humiliate me because I was an Anglo. I've always hated racial discrimination when it was practiced on me. But I evaluated wrong. And it went on like this. By the time I was a year sober, I finally, my sponsor had taken advantage of various times along the way to Every time I felt really bad, you'd get me to do something I wouldn't ordinarily do. The day I lost my job as a dishwasher, I decided to kill myself. I was going to walk to the ocean and kill myself. I remember Frederick March in an old movie called A Star Is Born. They did it later with many other versions, but the one I saw, he just walks in the ocean, and they're all sorry. Who was that wonderful man that we mistreated? So I walked to the ocean. And I just, Christ, I walked and walked and walked in the ocean. And I was so, I don't know if you ever get like that when you're depressed and you feel like Hamlet. And you just know that as you walk by people, they're saying, who was that tragic figure? What a terrible load he must carry, something we'll never understand. And what they're really saying is, did you see that asshole? You know. But I couldn't find the ocean. I finally stopped at the gas station. I said, where's the ocean? He said, you're just the western end of Beverly Hills, kid. Got to go another, out past the Veterans Hospital and another 5 miles. I said, well, I don't mind dying, but I'm not going to walk myself to death. So I called my sponsor. I hated to call him with bad news because he always was so cold when I had bad news. He liked good news. And I thought, I'm supposed to be a creative writer. I've been a good writer. Maybe my head is gone, but I'm going to try to give this guy such a sad story that even his heart will be touched. So I called him. I said, Bob?
Yeah? Why aren't you working?
I said, no, just a minute, Bob. Let me tell you something, Bob. You know, I've told you I lost my kids and I lost my home and you know all that, my family. And my parents don't talk to me. And you know all that. I told you that a long time ago. But there's something I've never told you, Bob. I've been going to meetings every night for 6 months. And even in AA, there's something terribly different about me. People treat me differently. Not in any way you can put your finger on, but it's almost as though they get along with each other, but they don't. They feel there's something different about me. Sometimes I go and sit down somewhere at the table. He'll get up and go to a different table to drink coffee. No one wants to especially sit next to you in meetings. They do, but they talk to the person on the other side of them. They all seem to be getting somewhere, Bob, and there's something terrible that just is terribly different about me, and I can't put my finger on it. I don't think I can survive it, Bob. What am I going to do?
Why don't you write your damn inventory the way I told you?
And that made me crazy. Really, Bob? And I told him again. I just told him 2 weeks before that. I took my inventory with a psychoanalyst. You know, with a professional. With a man who's been trained. Not a take some blabbermouth in AA. I said, my judgment, Bob, that's an inventory. Writing an inventory now, in my judgment, will kill me. I'm so caught up in defenses. What can I do? In my judgment, that's the last thing in the world I need. He said, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. He said, if I wanted your judgment, I'd come down and put my head in the back window and ask you for it. He said, I'm living in a big mansion in Pacific Palisades. Who cares how it looks to you? You got to turn off your judgment. You got to sublimate your judgment. You can't do that anymore. And that just made me crazy. It just, if I would have had the money, I didn't, but if I'd have had the money, I'd have called the World Service Office in New York. 686-1100 is the number. I just want you to know there's an old timer in Los Angeles killing newcomers. And I'll give you his name. And I'll just show you how funny it goes. Now it's something over 28 years later. When I talk to the World Service Office in New York, I say, no, I'm not. I've been on both ends of this, and being on the giving end is better. But that day, he got me so crazy, I took my inventory. Something I swore I'd never do to anything. I was so upset I put in things in which I wasn't a hero. He said, put in things you didn't tell your psychiatrist. I said, that's ridiculous. I told my psychiatrist everything. But I got right and I thought, I didn't tell my psychiatrist very much at all. I never wanted to tell my psychiatrist humiliating things. I always had this, wouldn't it be, how could you sit and talk to your psychiatrist and have him say, get out of my office, you sick bastard. So I told him what I thought he needed to know to help me. But I put stuff in inventory and God, it just, as a result of taking that inventory, nothing changed. I went to bed that night in the backseat of an abandoned car, half a day hungrier. But I'd proved that old fool writing an inventory didn't work, and that cheered me up. And a week later, I was going to commit suicide again, and I did something I swore I'd never do. I read this inventory to him. He drove in a car along the ocean to Oxnard, 40 miles away, and I sat on my side of the car with a flashlight reading this. And I was trying to explain to him, now this part I want to explain to you. I don't want to hear an explanation. Just read the goddamn thing. We got near Oxnard, and I thought, Jesus, he's going to put me out of his car. And I looked over, and he was going, oh. I thought I made him snap. But I now understand that I've taken that trip maybe 250 times since then on the driver's side. And I'm a much better listener than my sponsor was. I always turn my head. I just wish I'd hear something new. There's nothing ever new in an inventory once you've heard enough of them. In fact, once they start off in about 5 minutes, you can almost tell where they're going to go. You can tell when there's something left out. Did you leave out something there? Did you talk to that bitch? No. That's what comes next in that pattern. And as a result of that inventory, I took some other steps, and later on I took some amends. I made amends to people I hated. Probably one of the most significant amends I made in my life was to my father. And I was convinced, I told him, my sponsor, I can't make an amend to him. He hurt me much worse than I ever hurt him. He deserted my mother and I, and he's got remarried, and he's doing fine, and I'm the only child, and he always wanted great things for me, but he never helped me when I was in jail. He never would help me, never do anything for me. I hope to hell he dies. My son says, I don't want to hear it. You're going to write a letter of amend because you were a rotten son. I said, he made me rotten son. He said, we're not going to discuss that. You write him a letter. And I wrote him a letter. I just hated it. He said, I want to see it before you mail it. And he said, no, this isn't it at all. And he told me, I wrote a letter. And got a letter back from my daddy, very wary, like I wanted some money. He said, now write him back. You don't need any money. And I wrote him back. Little by little, I began to see my father as a different figure. By the time I was 3 or 4 years sober, I was back in visiting in Wisconsin. We wound up with about as good friends. And finally, with 20 years, very close together. He came out and lived with us. And I couldn't have been closer to him if we'd never had an absent day in my life. And when he died a couple of years ago, I was sitting at his bedside, and he squeezed my hand and smiled and died. And I thought, just think, if I hadn't surrendered my judgment, I would have missed my father. I mean, I could have made it without it, but a lot of things had come along. It's an amazing thing about amends. I don't mind making amends to people I like, but I hate to make them to people I hate. But it turns out that's one of the great reasons you make amends. Because once you make a good amends to somebody, you never hate him again. You never like him, maybe, but you don't ever hate him. And I did a lot of things like that over the years. And by the time I was a year sober, I finally held a job as a package wrapper in the back of an advertising agency. The same kind of job I'd had when I was 14 years old. And when I was 2 years sober, finally a guy gave me a little job as a writer in a medical corporation. And I went to my sponsor and I said, I got some money now to get some front teeth. I'm going to be an executive. Just take that money and send it to your kids in Dallas. They need it. I said, they've got front teeth, for Christ's sake. He said, just send them the money. So I sent them the money. I learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people never knew I didn't have front teeth. They just thought I'd been burned in a fire somewhere. But I went to work every day. That's nothing my sponsor did for me. You know, he used to do that every time I had a job. I'd see him in a meeting and say, you got to work today? Now, once, I said.
No, I didn't, Bob. I got thinking about I'll never see my kids again. I've lost so many opportunities, Bob. I couldn't face it. I just couldn't face it. I just couldn't get up and go to work. You understand that, don't you? He said,
no, I don't. That was then and this is now. Get up and go to work, for Christ's sake. Act like a man even if you can't be one.
But a lot of mornings I went to work just so I could bump in him at night.
Go to work today?
Yes, I went to work today.
I really fixed him. If I went to work every day and get a little better job and finally got some front teeth, but I'm almost 5 years sober as director of advertising for that big medical corporation. I was 6 years sober. They brought me into Revell. Some of you built Revell hobby kits and get together a big promotion where we gave away a jet plane and a big Revell sweepstakes. And I was 7 years sober. Another guy when I brought to Hollywood and we created the number one hard rock station in the world, something called Boss Radio. And we all wore shiny suits and popped our fingers and were hip. And I had an unerring judgment for talent. I made Sonny and Cher get out of my office because there were no talent pukes. And they made it for a while, but you notice eventually they went down. And the Rolling Stones, I thought they were the dreariest bunch I ever had and hated even me around them, and I guess they've done all right too. I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing private relations with the oil company. When I was 15 years sober, I was a marketing director for a big publishing firm in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, that wife and all those kids heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Texas, leaped out of their post office box, fled to my side. We immediately produced another Catholic who just got home from the university this week, and he's a big lump. He plays center. And he's in computer engineering. And he comes in where I'm watching the office. Do you mind if I want to watch something else, Dad? No, Christ. But the tie game, we don't care. Turn on Science Week. But and a whole bunch of grandkids and live in a house by the ocean, I've just become a wonderful person. This is the stage where all speakers try to look around at the newcomers if I can find them. And just, I don't say it, but I look at you and think, I've got it all together, and you haven't. And maybe never will have. There's only, you've sprung a leak there, my dear. There's only one thing I want to say, a little bit I want to say before I sit down. All this is correct and true. But the most important thing I've said tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, when I got up here, Dad, I said, my name is Clancy Immerslin, and I'm an alcoholic. Nobody paid any attention. He said, hi, Clancy. But that was the most difficult thing I've ever had to come to believe, and I didn't come to believe until after I was sober a while. How can you be an alcoholic when your problem really isn't alcohol? When it's all these other things, and you use the alcohol to offset them, and then that makes you goofy, and people think your problem is alcohol. But I know it isn't, and you know it isn't. What do you do? I had to stay here long enough to discover the most significant single thing I know about this illness. I'm going to say this slowly because it's going to sound upside down. But you better listen. I had to stay here long enough to discover if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I am an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound goofy and upside down and weird? But that's the story of what AA is about. I believe that's what that book's about. When I talked to Bill Wilson in his office 20 years ago, I got certainly the feeling that's what he felt it was about. What do you mean alcohol is not your problem? Everybody knows alcohol is the problem. If alcohol were the problem, I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out winners. And they don't. Hospitals turn out winners. Treatment centers turn out winners. Jails turn out winners. Toilets turn out winners. You can talk all you want about detoxes in hospitals, but the classic American detox is still the American bathroom. That's where more people get detoxed than any place. There aren't very many people in this room, I'm sure, who haven't knelt in front of the old porcelain altar in the morning and gazed into those shimmering waters and said your morning prayer. Oh, God. You hardly ever saw that.
I'm getting a free detox. This won't go on my insurance.
Some mornings when you're sick enough, your body will detox you from both ends at once. Good for your body, bad for your nerves. Not only are you terribly sick, but you're called upon to make a series of split-second decisions. And every answer must be correct. But I'll guarantee you one thing. You will always get sober again and again and again. If getting sober is the answer, there's no need for this therapeutic here. What is it I suffer from that isn't alcohol then? It's something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking in meetings, but it is not alcohol. It is something called alcoholism. And it's the same thing, isn't it? Not at all. There's a significant difference. The difference is just this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In this strange, deadly, eroding, disintegrating thing called alcoholism, you will discover that stopping drinking, per se, has no significant effect except to gradually make your life unbearable. And that's why people die from alcoholism. That's why today, with all the help available, 95 alcoholics out of 100 in America die drunk. I see them die every day. Some of you never see it, but I do. Of course, my job, I work the middle of Skid Row now, and I watch people die. But that's only 3% of them. The rest of them are people like you and me. And people going crazy. Now, when I say alcoholic insanity, that doesn't mean you're acting crazy running down the street. Alcoholic insanity, most of you have never seen a case of it, nor do you ever want to. I see it too much. When you just sit in a chair and people come and change your diapers 3 times a day and feed you and put you to bed and get you up and change your diapers, and you sit like that for 40 years perhaps, never know your name, don't know who you are. It's very similar to the last stages of syphilis, except that syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. Brain damage and alcoholism, you can stay, the rest of your body stays healthy forever. And it's just terrible. Now, alcoholism makes sobriety unbearable, creates holes in the emotion, brings about these feelings. But that isn't there are a lot of people like that who are not alcoholic. Because the other thing has to be present we talked about earlier. Alcohol has to have a special effect on you it doesn't have on most people who drink. 95% of people who drink, maybe. What is that special effect? Every time you go to a meeting, you'll hear ideas of what it may be. Well, some people say, well, if you're an alcoholic, you can't handle alcohol. Baloney. Studies approved, and your memory should tell you, an alcoholic should be able to handle alcohol better than a social drinker anytime. If you've ever been to a place where you all drank the same amount, I'd almost bet you drive the social drinkers home. But of course, you can hardly ever get them to drink the same amount. Oh, no more for me. I'm starting to feel it. But you feel this. But what's the worst night of the year to be out? New Year's Eve. Why? Because the streets are full of drunken social drinkers. They don't know when they're going to throw up. They don't. Everybody in this room has got at least 15 seconds. You know, you recognize it soon. Anybody got a cert? They don't know what's going on. You can be talking to them. They don't know when they're going to fall down. You know why they put up traffic blockades on New Year's Eve? It's to catch drunken social drinkers, not you and me. It's to catch people going, while decent citizens like us who know how to drink are behind them saying,
Hurry up there, for Christ's sake. Well, they say the special effect of alcohol on alcoholics is that it makes them crazy, makes them bizarre. It does that to some people, do that to me, but I watch people die who have never been bizarre once. They get more and more catatonic the worse they get. They never get bizarre. We hear a lot of bizarre speakers because they're more interesting, so we ask bizarre speakers to speak in AA. But most people don't have bizarre reactions to alcohol. They get terribly reactions, but not bizarre. Is it that if you're an alcoholic, you can't stop drinking? Is that it? You stay drunk all the time? False. Here's something you might think about the next time someone says, I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. It is physically impossible, pardon me, for a human body to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory. To say nothing on the street. You get sober again and again and again. If you can stay drunk, there's a very small membership in AA. Is that sobering up and being sober that makes you crazy? What is it then? What is the special effect? What does alcohol do to me? It doesn't do to my children. It doesn't do to my wife. It doesn't do to my parents. What the hell is it? And I'll tell you, I've been studying this for almost 3 decades. I've come to the conclusion alcohol does nothing to me, it doesn't do to them. In fact, it does less to me than would do to them. Then what is the special effect? And that is the thing we talked about to begin with tonight. That's what you got to remember. What makes an alcoholic is not what alcohol does to you. Just the opposite. It does something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. It almost instantly makes reality look different. It almost instantly changes your relationship to your environment. It almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained and them smaller and less threatening to me. It almost instantly fills my hole. And I never knew if it does that, it must almost surely kill me. And not even kill me quick, but a long life of countless vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking, knowing that somehow I can do it. Now that's the situation in alcoholism. You can't stay drunk and you can't stay sober. You drink and you get sober, and you drink and you get sober, and you drink and you get sober. And that's alcoholism. Nearly everyone who has it dies from it. I'll tell you something sad about it. A number of people in this room tonight who are sober will die from it. Die drunk. Not because AA doesn't work. Maybe me, maybe you. I'm not saying it's you. But I might, my head may carry me away someday and say, you don't need to do this stuff anymore. You learned your lesson. The man who taught me that, my first sponsor, he got mad at the group he founded after 15 years of sobriety and got mad at AA because they weren't doing it right. And he said, screw them, and stayed home. A few months he was taking pills. A couple months after that he was drinking. A couple months after that he was dead. And people came, I was only 2 years, almost 3 years sober. People said to me, Clancy, I hope this is going to make you crazy now because you barely are making it. Now your sponsor's drunk and dead. And I had just the opposite reaction. No. It proved what he said was true. What I couldn't believe is why he couldn't do it. Why he wasn't doing it, nothing was happening. When he got drunk, it proved what he had said was true. Now, what is the purpose of AA? This is the last thing I want to talk about, just for a second, and I'm going to stop. What's the purpose of AA? Do you think somebody gives the idea the purpose of AA is to come and be sober? False. Being sober doesn't make it better. Being sober makes it worse. The function of AA, its meeting, of getting a sponsor whom you cannot play around with, but who you will allow to intimidate you into taking actions that will save your life. The actions of AA, these absolutely irreplaceable steps, it still makes me crazy when I see people act the way I used to act, saying, well, if I could get a spiritual thing, I'd do these steps. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, you got to do them for a long time without believing them. And the nice thing about AA is, your motives aren't worth nothing. You take the actions, you'll get better. You don't take the actions, and you won't get better. That's the end of it. The purpose of all of these is not to make you holy or wonderful or above, no matter how hard you work the program, you'll never rise above human beings, and you'll always be imperfect, and you'll come up short a lot of times in what you know is against what you do. And that's why they say don't get too hungry or angry or lonely or tired, because they alter your perceptions and make you do dumb things. When I'm hungry, people act stupidly. I don't know why, but I have to call it to their attention. When I'm angry, God tells me to kill people for their own good. When I'm lonely, I know they're probably all at a party somewhere, but they didn't tell me, I noticed. When I'm tired, they attack me. Sometimes I get in that Santa Monica freeway in the morning, and people I never saw before know I'm tired. Just see an old lady in La Cienega. See the boy in the blue car? He's exhausted. I'm going to cut that son of a bitch off. But AA's taught me some lessons, too. I no longer have to pursue such people past my exit. If I haven't caught him by 4th Street, good flying, Red Bear, and we'll meet again. And when I do catch him, I can't do anything. I can go by him and give him a ray. That cheers me up somehow. A few months ago, a little girl, she must have been about 16 or 17, almost put me into the viaduct. Oh, I went after her like a rocket ship, I'll tell you. And I got next to her and I started giving her the real triple X-ray. I said, she looked at me and she looked just like one of my granddaughters. I have a granddaughter who's 17, 18, and going to college. And this sweet little girl, I thought, what if Katie Doherty in Albuquerque, New Mexico, what if some old grouchy son of a bitch was giving her the ray? I'd punch him in the nose. That's silly. This little girl's learning how to drive. It's a tough freeway and she's doing her best. And I gave her a smile and she went, she almost went to visit my grandma and get some homemade root beer right then. It was very close. But when I'm tired and take care of myself, people don't dare act that badly. That's why you got to take care of yourself, not for your sake, but for their sake. Keep them shaped up. But that's why I still am active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I know a great deal about AA, and I've met the founder, and I've known all the big people in AA, and I've been everywhere in the world in AA. But still, when I get up in the morning, my name is Clancy Immersland. I'm an alcoholic, and my emotions have to be dealt with to live comfortably in the world that day. The last thing I want to mention, you got to be careful you don't do it too long, though. Because if you do it too long, you may overshoot. I always wanted to be big in business and very successful and on top. And I did this too long. And one day I found myself leaving a job in Beverly Hills to go down and run a mission on Skid Row, the place that threw me out in 1958. And my friend said, "Why are you going down there for?" I was going to take a leave of absence and do it for 3 months, just so I could come back one place and said, "I told you I'd be back, you son of a bitch. Now, shape up." Just my luck, I got there and he was gone. So I've been there almost 14 years now. And it's much different. I used to be a big... Now, some mornings I go to work in the morning, I just hate to go. It's like watching the Mississippi River of misery, of watching people die all day long. Just hideous. When I go to work in the morning, I always hate to go to work Tuesday after Memorial Day. There'll be a lot of names dead and dying and dismay and disgust. And I go in there and I think about the days I used to sit and go up in the big elevator in Beverly Hills and pretty blondes would pour me orange juice. "Here you are, Miss Emerson." "Thanks, honey." When I go in Tuesday morning, I'll pour myself a cup of coffee and see who died. That's it. And do the best we can to keep people alive. But on the other hand, when I go home at night, I go out that Santa Monica freeway at night, back to my home out by the ocean. It's a funny thing. I have, my holes are more filled than they ever were going down all the elevators in Beverly Hills, popping my fingers in my shiny suit. And I don't, hard to explain that. Now, don't misunderstand me if you're new tonight. Even if you go to AA, even if you work the steps, even if you get a sponsor, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you can have your own mission. You know, there's only so many to go around. I got mine, and we can guarantee you something better than that. So we can guarantee you that little by little, walking and staying with people who are also trying to do it, that you will find your holes little by little filling up. And once in a while, in all human beings, they drain out, and you know how to fill them up again, little by little. That's what A is about, to learn to live with some degree of dignity on their terms, in their world, not taking my eccentricities and say, I'm sober now, Earth, you've got to accept me being crazy. AA prepares me to go out there and beat them at their own game and do what I want to do and live with a degree of peace that I never thought possible. So I'm glad to be here tonight. As I say, this convention put on by young people, but I'm glad to see there's old people in the crowd and people of all kinds, because that's what makes up AA. The only thing we have in common is that we have an unusual response to a chemical, and if we don't find an answer, it'll kill us. And if we do find the answer, we'll live better than we had any right to live ever. So let's keep looking. God bless us all. Thank you.